All right. Welcome, everybody. It's going to be fun talking with Bruce Anderson. I met him, I think, in 1986. And by that time, he had been in Alaska a teacher. He had been a mayor of a little town. He had become a fisherman and lived on an island off of Sitka. And then his life proceeded into other adventures. And why don't you take us on from there, Bruce? Tell us what happened when you sold your fishing boat.
Well, good morning. Nice to be on the call. It's fun to talk about these ideas. They're kind of my lifeblood. So I got off a fishing boat and walked into a local social service place to volunteer, and my red rubber boots and wool pants and jacket, and through a string of events that looked accidental almost at the time, but you know, as you get older, you look back and see things aren't so accidental as they might appear when you're in the middle of it. I ended up managing the place, and it was a multi-service, kind of typical social service place full of really good people. Working hard, and I'd never been connected with a social service place before. My family were scrappers, and we kind of made it on our own rather than depended on services. So it was an unfamiliar world to me, and a lot of it didn't make sense. But I assumed it was all working fine because there were highly trained people there who were really good and really skilled and had huge hearts. And there was an event that was going to take place in Fairbanks that the previous director was going to go to, and the tickets were already purchased, and the office manager said, well, I think you better go to this, Bruce. So I went up to Fairbanks and walked into a room, a really bad motel meeting room, and there was a strange guy in black clothes and suspenders up front and talking about how everybody had capacity, and his partner then got up and talked, and it was John O'Brien and Connie Lyle O'Brien. And so they really got in my brain that everyone has capacity no matter what. And through meeting them, they're from Georgia, I ended up going to Georgia, and I walked in another room about a month later, and you were standing in the front of the room, John, talking about the importance of community. So my path really got cemented then of realizing everybody's got capacity on one hand, and community is what makes it all happen on the other hand. But I was still really pretty invested in human service kind of stuff until I met a guy named Michael Mead, who's doing some really dangerous and risky and really good work with young people who are struggling in their life. He and a renegade bunch of four or five other guys, and I joined up with them and started doing events with him over a period of time, and he drugged me out of human services and into the world of myth and ritual and indigenous practice. And so I've tried to live in that gap in between what our ancestors know is true and what modern community development says is true. And where that's landed for me is there are three glues that hold people together, whether it's a family or whether it's an organization or whether it's a community, and that's that everyone has gifts, unique gifts, and everyone has this desire, this inbred desire to feel welcome, and it's a community's job to make that happen. And then the third piece of glue is the ritualized behavior that the individuals and groups use to hold themselves together, and that can be incredibly negative and hostile and toxic, or it can be really hopeful and generous and full of love. So everything we do really ties into those three ideas of gifts and welcoming and hope. And I don't think you can talk about one without talking about the other. So anyway, that's what's landed me on this phone call this morning, is this urgency, this drive I have that has never gotten less. It's only increased over 28 years. To really study those three things and then play them out in real life.
And when you talk about the third element, you mentioned ritual and ancestors. I sort of associate that with the idea of a culture. I wonder if you could say a little more about that.
Yeah, it does go back to the idea of culture. One of the things that's been interesting is in tracking the field of organizational development and tracking the field of cultural anthropology and then tracking the field of positive psychology. It's all three of those, although they each use their own jargon language and they each claim credit for it, they've landed in the same spot in the last 5 years, and that's that any group needs four types of ritualized behavior to hold itself together. One of them is rituals in the area of celebrating and grieving, and the second kind of ritual that all groups need are called personal identity rituals. They are activities that help each member be more clearly seen. And the third kind of ritual is learning rituals, which traditionally was mentoring and now is in the now in organizations is in this field of ongoing learning groups. And then the fourth ritualized area are community engagement ritual. What are the things that we hang on to as a group, and how does each person see those things and participate in those things? So more and more, in the last 5 years, I've been on this train of really studying how cultures developed rituals. And we do lots of work with all different kinds of group around developing rituals that make sense to them, whether they're in a church or a social service place or a family that's trying to stay united.
Can you give an example of what you call a ritual, just to make it concrete, like a community engagement ritual or a personal identity ritual?
Sure. So, I mean, one typical thing, you know, tying it to the idea of gifts, one typical thing that organizations often do is each person spends time with another person or with the group, really identifying the primary gift they're trying to bring to their group. And then a ritual might be for that group to create a wall with those gifts written on it, and then to walk up to a table that has some nice greenery on it and some water and some earth and some candles, and to light a candle and say what your gift is, what you're trying to bring, and then one person that helped you get there along the way. So there's all different kinds of ritualized behavior. There's information on our website about how to develop rituals and different kinds of rituals. But this idea that we keep going back to these primary things, that there's this remembering that keeps our feet on the ground and our heart attached, I think is what we lose in the pace of everyday life.
You have some rules that have been very helpful. Can you remind us of those?
Well,
sure.
Let me stop a second. Could you give us the website? Because some people can even be looking at it as they're listening to you.
Communityactivators.com the website. But I think an even more useful thing, at least more interesting to me, is we have a Facebook page, Facebook.com/communityactivators. And it's not a list of our activities. It's really just posts every week or so about gifts and welcoming and hope. And you can get a pretty good idea of what we're about. And there's definitions of ritual on that page and examples of rituals. There's a lot of ritual information on that Facebook page.
Now, Josh, thank you. Sorry for the interruption. John, you were asking about these 11 rules. So I think they'd be fun to have you talk a little about even the idea behind the rules, how you use them, and maybe one or two that you think have been most durable.
Well, the rules emerged for us quite a few years ago as just things we kept seeing. And the rules were really an effort for us to blend community development practice within human service and community activities. And so there are rules around gifts, there's rules around suffering, there's rules around the kinds of questions you ask. And so that was really the intent, was to blend those two things. I think that the two rules that have been most useful to me are that everything keeps going back to gifts. Anymore, mm-hmm. when I'm working with groups or groups are trying to work on something, you can't get very far unless each person is clear about the primary contribution that they're trying to make. Because that gives other people in the group compassion when they say it wrong or do it wrong. If you know somebody's primary gifts, you also understand the weapons they're going to use when they don't get enough sleep or when they're angry at you. Because our most powerful gifts are also how we choose to hurt other people. And so groups being clear about their gifts is just the primary ground, I think, that people have to stand on if they're really interested in moving forward together. So this idea of gifts is really important to me, and it's always one of the first questions I ask, do you know each other's gifts? Because I'm not sure we can get very far unless we're clear about that. And we've done a lot of work over the years. People toss this word gifts around, and one of the trains I've been on is to try and dive a little deeper into the word and figure out what the word actually means and bring some definition to it and bring some examples to it so people can be clearer about the paths that they're on.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
And you said there were two rules. What's the second?
Looking beyond the third one, looking beyond the surface level messages we see in somebody, like I don't have a place to live, or I'm hungry, I need a job. That's a human services approach to try and solve those needs. But the idea that I'm more interested in is the idea of seeing yourself in the other person. And you can't see yourself in another person or you perceive as having needs unless you go back to the ground you're both standing on, which is both of us have felt like we belonged and both of us have felt like we don't belong. And let's start from there, because that gets us on common ground together and gets us out of, I'm going to help you because I'm in a better place than you. About pity and charity, and I'm more interested in both of us starting with our actual gifts and our actual wounds and moving forward together. And I think that's about this idea of not belonging, which brings me to welcome Vashon, if I could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, please. First, give us a bit about Vashon that people may not know.
Okay, Vashon is it's an island suburb of Seattle, about 10,000 people. It's 15 miles long and 5 miles wide or so. It's an island community. I think 60 or 70% of the residents commute to Seattle or Tacoma every day. It's not a traditional suburb in the sense that there aren't housing developments as such, and you have to take a ferry. But the ferry is only 15 minutes long, so it really does function in some ways as a bedroom community for people who are working off island. But there's a long practice here of people also remaining on the island, and people of all kinds end up living here. So a couple of years ago, 3 years or so ago, a guy who had been the director of special services, special ed for our school district, he hadn't made much progress in helping kids who were in the margins in the school district be more a part of their schools and more a part of the community. And he wanted to, he quit his job and was in the midst of figuring out what to do next. And he decided he would still poke away at this idea of helping kids who felt like they didn't belong be more a part of our community. And so he decided to start a project from outside the school district rather than inside the school district. And he'd heard about me, so he gave me a call and had a cup of coffee and talked about this idea of helping kids belong, and particularly kids who had been in special ed. And the more he talked, I noticed the more I was losing my energy, and not because it's not a good thing to do and not because he's not a great man. He is a fabulous human being. It's just that I just don't believe anymore in helping one group, one class of citizen belong more. I think the way to approach it is to start from this common ground. All of us don't belong, and all of us belong. And that's a richer question to both ask and try and answer than to help one group who's traditionally been marginalized belong. And so... And that really came out of, we used to do a lot of storytelling, coaching, and training. And one of the stories we always asked people to do during these workshop-y kind of days was to tell a story about a time when they felt like they didn't belong. And I was amazed by both by people's surprise at the powerfulness of them telling that story from their own life, and that it didn't matter, you know, rich kids from the suburbs and poor kids who were seen as coming from the wrong side of the tracks, both had those stories, and often both began to weep when they told them. So I began to see that this desire to belong doesn't really know any class. It doesn't know any caste. It's in all of us, whether we want to talk about it or not. And so that's really made me want to focus on whole community belonging rather than one particular segment. So I told Dan Kaufman is his name. He's a great guy on our island. And I told him I just didn't have the energy to participate in that, and I wished him well. And as I was leaving, I said, you know, but I am interested in whole community welcoming, and if you want to work on that sometime, I'd be right on board with you. And I didn't hear from him for a couple months, and he called me back and said, I got the people. And I said, what do you mean you got the people? And he said, well, I got 15 or 16 people, and they're all interested in making our community more welcoming. And I said, how'd you find him? And he said, well, I had coffee with you, and I had coffee with another person, and when I asked them who the most welcoming person was to them, they told me a name, and I called that person up and met with them, and then I asked that person who the most welcoming person they knew was, and then I called and asked that person out for coffee, and sooner or later I had 15 or 16 people, all of whom said they were interested in welcoming in our community. And it was, you know, it was the customer relations person at the power company, it was a pastor in town, it was a school teacher, it was a couple high school kids. There were people from all walks of life in our town. And so we met at my place and had a bowl of soup and decided to have a community event, decided to form a loose-knit group called Welcome Vashon and decided to have an event and see if anybody else in our town was interested in this generic idea of welcoming. And we made all this preparation and we gathered in this beautiful space and there was food on all these tables. And at 9:30 in the morning, it was the 16 of us sitting there alone. And we decided, you know, we were the only ones who cared. And by 9:45 or 9:50, there were 165 people in the room. People just, you know, it was Saturday morning. People just didn't feel like they had to get anywhere right on time. And so 165 people for 2 or 3 hours talked about welcoming and came up with ideas. And one of the criteria that we had was, this is not a brainstorming session. Only tell us your idea if you're interested in starting on it now and you're interested in hosting it until it's done. And so people stood up with a simple piece of paper with their project, and then people reorganized around about 20 different activities. All in that person's mind pointed at the idea of creating a more welcoming community. So we did it really with no money at all. And out of the 22 things, I think about 3/4 of them ended up coming to completion and were successful, which in community organizing odds, when there's no pressure and people only have to do stuff if they feel like it, 15 out of 20 things to me is a fantastic success.
Huge.
Yeah. And so, and it really has to do with this core group of 15 or so people, which has dwindled to 12 or 13 now. A couple of people moved off the island, and we've shape-shifted a little bit. But it's a group of people that I look forward every month to those folks and sharing a bowl of soup with them, because they're so different from me, and yet they have this intense curiosity and passion, mostly rooted in their own story about what's it going to take for our community to be more welcoming. And we've met every month for a couple of years over a bowl of soup and accomplished lots of things together. And most of the good ideas have come when we didn't expect them through casual conversation.
I was just looking at the website of Welcome Vashon, and for those people who are listening, I really encourage you to look at it. It's this welcomevashon.org, and it's a phenomenal exploration of the possibilities that people have come up with. A couple of them that strike me, and I wanted you to say a bit about them. you have a publication, or maybe it's on the website, I'm not sure what, called Voices from the Verge. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. One of the things that a woman named Julie Morser and Janie Starr were interested in is there, you know, we live in a community where there's rich people, there's poor people, there's all different kinds of people, and there's a significant number of people that feel on the edge and on the verge and are seen by other people as being either trouble or not quite worthy. And they decided to write a series of articles in our local weekly paper about people who other people in the community might see as being in the margins or in the shadows, and not to talk about the struggle of their life story, but to talk about what they were bringing to the community that the community had no idea that they were bringing. And they were interested in reshaping this idea that there's the haves and the have-nots and the needy and the not needy, and in their own way writing these articles. And they wrote a lot of them, and that resulted in a little chapbook called On the Verge, which has which is distributed widely in our community. So the newspaper was totally willing to go along with it and supported it all the way.
I see another one that sounds interesting, that people every day of the week are cooking meals for the community for people who want to come for all kinds of reasons. Can you say something about that?
Sure. There are every day of the week in our town, there's a meal that some group of folks puts on. Organizations sponsor these meals, just loose collectives of people sponsor these meals. And it's every model from people showing up and cooking together and eating together some nights to some people cooking in their homes and five people bringing things that they've cooked for a bunch of people to share. There's all different kinds of strategies around that, depending on where they're meeting and, you know, what the health department rules are and all that kind of stuff. One thing that's interesting to me is the person who coordinates that, he's part of one of the nights that I participate in, one of the dinners, and he told me that they actually have a waiting list of people who want to get in on it in our town, who want to help cook and want to participate in the meals. They've got more people wanting to do it than there are spaces for people to cook. And so I thought that was an interesting idea. It gets past this idea that the resources are scarce and somehow we could do more if we just had more. And yet when you provide the right opportunity and frame it in a certain way, there's more people who want to do it than are often needed to make it happen. It's an interesting problem to have.
Yes. There's also, I note, an all-island forum. What's that?
Well, our island has a long history of we're not an incorporated town, and there has been a community council for years and years, and it tends to go along for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and the politics of it shape shift, and, you know, it's a bunch of renegades that live here, and people will start not behaving civilly towards each other, and then it kind of implodes, and then another group takes charge of it. And I've been here 26 years now, and there's been a lot of different iterations of the Vashon Community Council. And so there's a small group of people on our island who are really interested in the idea of different approaches to community consensus. And they formed a group, and they've had, I think, 3 or 4 different all-island forums now that are really meant to think about what we'd want our community to look like 20 years from now. And so they're slowly working on that outside the reins of the local community council.
And that's the kind of thing where patience seems to me to be a great virtue. These things don't happen in one planning session.
Yeah, I think patience is the key. We're this core group of 15 people or so in Welcome Vashon. We're in a not a lull, but a kind of a calm, peaceful state right now. We don't have any huge things going on that we're all invested in, and yet we keep meeting every month. That the act of coming together over time gets a group where it needs to go if you're willing to stay committed. And so I don't have any doubt, and I'm sure other people in our group don't have any doubt, that we're going to hit on some more things that we're interested in if we just stick together here and keep eating soup together.
That's wonderful.
When it'd be easy to quit, it'd be easy to go to some action, go to something hot that's happening right now and pour your soul into it. And so it's that the group has taught me so much about patience and sticking with it. And one other thing about Welcome Vashon that's been a primary learning thing for me, and I didn't realize it till somebody asked the question. Somebody similar said, "Well, Bruce, why didn't you know something about community organizing?" And Jim Deers lives on the island here, an old crony in the ABCD group, and a lot of people have a lot of skills around community organizing and development on our island. And somebody said, "Why don't you just do regular old community organizing?" And, you know, get 15 or 20 things to happen as a way to make your community more welcoming. And my answer to that, and I didn't really realize it at the time, but my answer to that is the platform that you choose to springboard off makes all the difference. And we didn't want to spring off a platform of community organizing. We wanted to springboard off the idea of welcoming. And that frames and flavors everything you do, and to me gets at this idea of who belongs and who doesn't. It has a profound effect, the route you go back to tap for ideas.
That's a great, great insight. I notice you also have on the Welcome Vashon site something called Welcome Talk. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that it was a series of articles in which you're asking people throughout the island questions about how they welcome people. What does welcome mean to them? A nourishment of that idea?
Yeah, we decided just to have, there's a woman who's part of our group, Jen Rydell, who's fascinated by different people who, some of whom are, you know, not the standout people in our community, the people who get seen all the time, just to do short snippet interviews with a really wide variety of people around what welcoming means to them, both in our town and in their lives personally. And so, I don't know, there's probably 10 or 15 of them now, but we try every month or month and a half to interview a new and different kind of person about welcoming. So we begin to collect those stories over the years, so we have a ritual to go back to. Look, all these years people have been talking about welcoming.
One other item that struck me as interesting is it's obvious that the idea of health and being healthy is spreading throughout the society. And there's something there at Vashon called Shape Up Vashon. Can you tell us about that?
I can, but I can't tell you very much. It's, you know, I'm
not
that
healthy.
You're not very healthy. This is a gift-based thing, right? Not one of my gifts. It's a physician, two physicians in town, a couple who are really interested in how to get at the idea of being healthy from a citizen-led initiative rather than a health organization led initiative. And they have a whole system of ways for people to get to know each other and track each other and stay healthy and connect with what each other is doing. And those things are hard to get off the ground, and they did not give up. They kept at it, and they're 2.5 years into it now, and they're still going strong. And it to me, it's a really good example of people coming together to create health and then becoming healthy themselves as a result, as a group. So I got to hand it to her. It's really something that she's doing. I know we're getting to the end here. I'd like to just talk briefly about this idea of gifts a little bit, if you indulge me.
We've got about 15 minutes. Maybe we could stop and see if there's questions. Dan, you want to kind of cast the net to see if there's questions, and then we'll come back to the gifts, Bruce.
For sure. I'll just remind everybody who is calling in that if you do have any comments or questions, you can just press star 8 on your phone. And the people who are following along online can continue to post as they have been in the chat window.
Okay, great. So while we're waiting for that, there is a question somebody posted on the chat. Says, I'm very curious about Bruce's choice to avoid community organizing, but not clear on what exactly he means by the difference. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit. Maybe that relates to the gifts thing too, Bruce.
Well, I think the community organizing movement has evolved. You know, it started with the model of whoever can scream the loudest and get the most people and get their way. And that's a great strategy in some situations. And John and some other people brought the idea of, you know, asset-based community development. And I think there's a building off of that. There's a next generation. And I think it involves two things. I think it involves coming from a platform of belonging and not belonging as the fundamental underpinning of the activities. And mm-hmm. I think it comes from a clear distinction around what the idea of gifts mean and how we really welcome people for their gifts. So I'm all over the idea of community organizing. I just think it's morphing right now and continuing to grow and shape shift and offer new insights and new capacity as we learn more about what it means along the way.
Yeah, when you said the platform makes a difference, in a way you're defining context and the power of the platform.
Yeah.
And
if
it's organizing, which is to solve a problem, usually that somebody else, you aimed at somebody else, where you found in the word welcoming, it creates an equalizing word, an equalizing idea. So I'm interested in your thinking about the local economy, about poverty, and I would guess that you would pick a platform of poverty to stand on. You pick a platform of welcoming, so that what we usually want to talk about is problems. Your stance is to say, well, let's talk about how we welcome and get connected to the people that we're concerned about.
Yeah, and so the fundamental question is, how are we all going to belong, and how does each one of us feel right now? How we don't belong. I walk into a room full of people. I public speak a lot. I do lots of community work. I'm a very timid and shy person. When I walk into a room, I gotta know it matters to somebody else that I'm there. It's the first thing on my agenda always. And I think that's true with most of us, if not all of us. And so I think coming from this question of who belongs and who doesn't, and then springboarding projects off of that, for instance, food stuff, is better than just starting with food. That's context.
Yeah, it's power, very powerful. And also, I just resonate to what you're saying so much, because I feel where maybe years ago anxiety was the cultural symptom, and now I think it's isolation. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're really speaking right into the center of our isolation. And so that's something very resonant about that, that you're dealing with the fact that it's our isolation. It's the root cause of much of our suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's the core. I just think it's the core of all suffering. And that's why the idea of gifts is so powerful, because it's been the cultural practice for being seen. You know, youth initiation rituals, different club rich. It's the way we get seen in the way that we want to get seen. So I just think that's the fundamental pathway into belonging. And it's why I was so glued on to John when I first met him, because it was all about capacity. It wasn't about the needs. And that was such a hard idea for me to accept, because I felt so privileged, and I am so privileged. And it wasn't until I could see my own gut-wrenching neediness.
Exactly.
That thing began to change in me. We can argue all day about who suffered more. We can argue all day about that, and a lot of people want to argue about that, but I don't think that's the talk we need. I think the talk we need is what's the stranger in all of us, and what are we going to do about it?
So there's another. Dan, is anybody calling in?
We have no one on the line right now.
Okay. So there's another question typed in. It says, Bruce, you mentioned you spent quite a lot of time thinking about the definition of gift. How do you define it? Maybe a little more on that would be helpful.
Well, I think we've evolved. We've evolved over the years. It started. There's been two kind of generations. One is we got onto this idea about 20 years ago that this idea of path, pathology, that the path you're on is both can be the disease and the healing, and the idea of gifts and wounds is attached onto that. Pretty much in all cultures that we've found. And so we latched onto this idea that maybe there is one thing that a person is trying to bring to the world more than anything else. And for the last 25 years, we've been working on a short interview process that's being used by churches now and human service groups, the Buddhist Insight Network, pilgrimage and trekking groups, homeless outreach groups. It's an interview process that results in the person being clear about what they're really trying to bring to the world more than anything else. And it may be a gift of structure and order. It may be a gift of peace. It may be a gift of truth seeking. It may be there's all kinds of, there's as many gifts as there are people. But for a person to be clear about what they're trying to bring more than anything else, I think is extremely useful. And for some people, just accepting that they have a gift is transformational in their psyche. So we've been working on this gift interview for a long time. And the second thing is about 5 years ago, we were able to get enough of a balcony view that we saw that in human beings, there are three different clusters of gifts. There are gifts of talent, and we latched right on to the ABCD practice of gifts of the head, hands, and heart. Those are all gifts of talent. They're natural abilities and desires we come into the world with. One cluster. The second cluster of gifts are gifts of wisdom. And these are ideas and wisdom that have come to us from outside sources that have significantly shaped our life. And we tend to want to re-gift those things to the world. So it could have been wisdom that came from sitting by a river, could have come through prayer. It's come to me through things, offhand remarks that John McKnight's made to me. But their gifts of wisdom is another cluster of gifts that each of us has. And then the third kind of gift is a gift from a passage. A very old idea. It's not possible to go through a suffering or difficult event without receiving a gift. Not possible. You may never see it. You may never get to the point where you want to acknowledge it, but not possible. And so there are these three clusters of gifts, and we all have all three clusters inside of us. Although some of us tend to gravitate towards one cluster more than the other. So we have three simple worksheety kinds of things on that Facebook page for each one of those. We call them three gift buckets, but they're little worksheets that help people figure out their gifts in all three of those areas. Go ahead.
I would assume that what you're creating is not an expert-based methodology, that anybody can learn to do these interviews to discover the gifts of the people around them.
You bet. I used to think it was somebody who needed a lot of communication training, and then I ended up in a room in Sacramento, California in 1990-something. I ended up, through a long story, in a room with 30 people, all of whom had been institutionalized more than three times at Napa State Mental Institution. I ended up in a room with them, and they were interviewing each other to discover this, what we call a core gift in each other, and coming up with them on their own without any help from me. And they ended up, at the end of the day, most of them weeping, saying that it had been so long since anybody saw anything in them. They were able to do it without any expert help.
I think there's so much value in this aspect of illuminating and then sort of feeding back to each other the nature of gifts, because it's an experience, especially for people who've been pushed aside or on the verge, that people rarely have. And they the blossoming that you can see when people begin to see that you actually believe they might have something and that you have something as well to share with them. That's the basis for a relationship, it seems to me, that will always lead in the right direction. It's very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. So there's another question. Somebody said the clarified gift of passage. Do you mean lessons from experience? Maybe just a couple of lines on that, Bruce. We're coming near the end.
Gifts of passage always involve suffering or difficulty.
Yeah.
I think, personally, are the most powerful kind of gift because they have in them three different things. Passage gifts make a distinction between cure and healing. We may not get cured from our life difficulties, but that doesn't mean they're not part of our healing path. Passage gifts also distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain is something you want to get rid of, but the legacy of gifts and wounds is that out of our suffering comes gifts, and they transform who we are. So the suffering is useful. It's an old Buddhist idea. That suffering is useful. It's not to be gotten rid of. You mine it for its usefulness. And the third thing is that when you go through a difficult life experience, the modern cash economy tries to get us to get things back to normal. My wife had breast cancer, and the message that we were trying to send to each other as husbands, wives, we got to get our family back together. We got to get it back like it was before you had cancer, Gina. And, you know, the truth is it never goes back to the way it was. These experiences significantly transform who we are, and it's not until you begin to mine the gifts from the experience that you really transform yourself and become even more in many ways than you were before that happened to you. And so the beauty in the suffering and its capacity to produce a gift is, to me, it's almost an unspeakable beauty.
What I just impresses me so much is that you've integrated these worlds. There's a lot of tradition about individual healing and individual insight, and you obviously have done a lot of thinking about that. But you also say it occurs in community.
Oh.
And it's a collective process. It's not something that I have to deal with on my own or with one or two other people. It's a communal. And I think that integration. So special and powerful.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine, Maladoma Somei. He's an elder in the Dagara tribe in Burkina Faso, West Africa. And at one point in my life, I was spending a lot of time around him. And he said to me, Bruce, you Westerners, you just don't understand. There's two things you never do alone. You never celebrate alone, and you never suffer alone. I've never forgotten that. I've never forgot him saying that.
Right, yes. Yeah, but we figured out a commercial way to deal with suffering alone, and that is pay for a psychiatrist or a counselor.
Here we go.
And the long-term result of that is to begin to say about people who are suffering who need us to be with them as we need them to be with us, you need professional help. And that's one of the most powerful ways of breaking a community's capacity to lead us together, each other, in our times of suffering through to take a path together.
So we're kind of at the 45-minute mark. I'm wondering if there's any final thoughts. Bruce, anything you'd like to share in terms of how people can reach you or things
well,
like that?
I hate to end by talking about suffering. Our website is great, and my personal email is banderson@communityactivators.com, or you can get me through the info link on our website. And I'm always interested in what people are thinking, and particularly when they think different things than I do. And so interested in staying connected, and Facebook page, welcome Facebook / Community Activators, and the welcomevashon.org website. So I just want to take a minute just to thank the two of you, and Peter, you're a recent entry into my life. I have a hunch that if I would have known about you sooner, I would have moved on to your front porch for a while. So I just want to thank both of you for what you're doing, and just tremendous influence and legacy.
I just thank you, and I just, Bruce, it's nice to meet you this way. I just appreciate your thoughtfulness. You understand the power of an idea, and then to patiently bring it into the world. Even when you know, there's so many things you said I would love to spend a week on, which is, you know, in a cash world, a cash economy. We want to get things back to normal, which is a defense against everything you're talking about. And I noticed on your website you're doing the time banking, or you're connected with time banking.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way you're taking these core ideas about gifts and bringing them into all kinds of domains, I'm just so grateful for.
Thanks. There's a lot of tricksters trying to get us to look the other way. I just think we have to keep our eye on the prize of gifts, welcoming, and hope.
Yeah.
And Bruce, I want to thank you for your understanding of an evolving approach. And I was especially taken by the fact that Welcome Vashon is called a hub, which seems to me to be a very useful way of thinking beyond an organization with its more formal structure. So I think you're bringing a new way, revealing it, exploring it together, and that's really helpful. So thank you.
You bet. Well, I'm just a bit player in that whole thing. I'm a little bit of a bind here, John, because in 45 minutes, there's all those folks are coming to my house for soup today.
Yeah.
And I gotta be sure I say enough nice things that they'll eat my soup.
Yeah, right. Well, we understand. This is a collective activity.
Yeah, good.
All right, Dan, you want to close for us?
Sure thing. Thank you again, Bruce, for joining us today. And thank you, everyone who's following along online and calling in and joining us on this call. If you'd like to learn more, Bruce already gave you a few links, but just to remind you that you can go to communityactivators.com, or you can also visit their Facebook page at facebook.com/communityactivators. If you'd like to hear this call or some of our previous calls, you can visit us at abundantcommunity.com. And we look forward to our next call, which is on October 22nd with Howard Lawrence. Howard has been a pastor in Edmonton, Canada, for over 25 years, and he's pioneering a major new Abundant Communities initiative with the city of Edmonton. So thank you again, everyone, for joining us, and thank you, Bruce, Peter, and John, and we look forward to talking to you all next time.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.